Hey everybody, it's time for Beyond the Matrix, that show that asks you to get outside the box of conventional thinking, and boy, what better time than now. I mean, I think by now we've all got the buzz. Disclosure is getting closer and closer. Just if you're watching the news, if you're reading between the lines, we've got NASA admitting that that fossil that old Bill Clinton had in his hands, and they said, no Martian bacteria in here. Apparently now NASA's saying, well, shucks, maybe it is, in fact, bacteria. But of course, that doesn't mean there's any life on Mars now. Well, I think that we're really being prepped here, and in at least my circles of friends and contacts, the word is out. Contact is imminent. The Syrians told us so. So many wise people have been preparing us. Geez, I know many of you, like me, when you were kids, were already talking about aliens. And so I thought, well, here's the guy that I want to have on my show today. So I've told him, come on, and let's blow the lid off. Not that he has any trouble doing that with his myriad books. His name is Nick Redfern. His latest book, I think you're going to love this one, it's called Contactees, A History of Alien-Human Interaction. And we're going to talk about as much as we can cram into this hour. Hiya, Nick. Are you there?
Hi, Pat. Yes, I am. Thanks for having me on.
Ah, thanks for coming. I just, I haven't completed your book yet, but because I just got it, but it is so compelling and so the now moment and so in sync with everything that I live for. So I'm delighted to have a chance to talk to you personally and to be able to share your wisdom with my audience.
Sure.
So before I dive into the book, would you give us a little background on your incredible history? I mean, you've got everything from Bigfoot to aliens to even Hollywood scandal psychic phenomena. You are my guy.
Well, actually,
you've got a number of books out, huh?
Yeah, I've done quite a lot of books over the years. Probably about 15 years I've been writing books, something like that. But when I first finished at school, I began working on a rock music magazine in England, and so that sort of got me involved in the world of writing and, you know, knowing how to interview people and learning various techniques relative to magazines, newspapers and bookwork, etc. So that sort of really got me involved in writing as such. And I'd had an interest in, I suppose, the paranormal for many years, because my father was in the British Royal Air Force and worked on radar, and he was actually involved in several UFO incidents in the early 1950s when UFOs were tracked
back in the Blue Book days.
What's that?
Back in the Blue Book days.
Yeah, that's right. This time period, sort of 52, late 1952, and he was worked on radar and was involved in several cases where very fast-moving UFOs were tracked flying over the east coast of England and the North Sea, and aircraft were scrambled to try and intercept these things. The pilots couldn't get close, and everybody was basically taken into a room after the incidents occurred and told, you know, you won't talk about this incident. And my dad didn't tell me till I was about 14 or 15. And it was, I suppose, the combination of having been exposed to the UFO subject by someone who wasn't just my own dad, but he was also, you know, an expert. I'm working on radar for the military. That sort of really hit home that UFOs existed. And then when I began doing the magazine work when I was sort of 17, 18, I thought, well, you know, why don't I try and combine the two? The interest in
great
the
idea.
Paranormal and, you know, with the investigative journalism side as well. So
fantastic. Well, what a privilege to have had an inside scoop from someone of his credible stature.
Yeah, my dad didn't tell me until sort of the late 1970s, 79, something like that. And, you know, he kept it quiet since 1952 when it occurred. And so
he was probably trying to protect you, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, when he told me in 79, I was only like sort of 12, 13, something like that then. So, you know, I think it was one of these things where I probably wouldn't have appreciated it when I was sort of four or five, or whatever. It would have just gone over the, you know. But over the top.
But you've always been fascinated with the Loch Ness Monster, the Chupacabras, which I'd like to speak to you about today, Bigfoot. So, I mean, you're really out there, like me, diving into every possible paranormal encounter and subject area.
The two things that interest me most of all, I suppose, are UFOs and cryptozoology, being, you know, the study of unknown animals. And I think the reason I'm interested and I enjoy doing that is because, you know, it allows you to get out into the field and do expeditions, you know, and I like that sort of on-the-road aspect of it as well. So
do I. Did you actually get out and investigate chupacabras in Puerto Vallarta? Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I've been to Puerto Rico on a number of occasions on expeditions, first time in 2004 with a friend of mine from England, John Downs, and we went out there for a couple of weeks and interviewed a lot of eyewitnesses, farmers, police officers, veterinarians, all sorts of people who in different capacities had had involvement, whether it was like ranchers and farmers whose animals had been attacked and drained of blood, or veterinarians who were examining the corpses and doing autopsies, or even police officers who had actually gone out officially on a number of occasions to investigate these cases. And, you know, the first time I went, I sort of came away with a big appreciation of how serious the whole Chupacabra mystery is taken on the island. And that's something I've found every time I've been back there, and, you know, got a lot of good solid reports of people who've seen the creature, and you know, whether driving home late at night through the rainforest or in the little villages, and a lot of rancher reports. So I think that's, you know, that's why it's important to sort of get out there, because that allows us then to, you know, find the witnesses that otherwise we might not even know about.
Yeah. Well, before we get on your new book, I'd like to pursue this a little bit more, because I have a personal thirst for information about chupacabras, and I would like to ask you, do you feel that this is an alien or a species that's been introduced here, or it looks to me like it's some kind of laboratory aberration
they're
playing with down there. What's your scoop on this?
Well, the interesting thing about the Chupacabra is that if you look at things like the Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot, you can find reports actually go back hundreds of years. In the case of Loch Ness Monster, like 1,000 years with the story of St. Columba. But the Chupacabra is a relatively new phenomenon, and that's what sets it apart from many other mysteries. It's almost as if it suddenly surfaced out of nowhere, sort of 15 years ago or so. Now, Puerto Rico a few years earlier did have reports of creatures that were known as devil birds, and another one known as the Mocha vampire. Mocha's an area on Puerto Rico. So there were sort of a few little precedents, but nothing on the scale of what we saw in the 90s. Which, as I said, does make it sound like a more modern-day mystery. Now, every time I've been to Puerto Rico, which has now been a number of occasions, people have said to me, oh, you know, we think the Chupacabra is an alien. Other people went along with the idea of some sort of genetic experiment. Most of the theories broadly fell into that category. There were some people who, you know, literally looked at it as like a paranormal, supernatural creature, but I think the UFO angle and the idea of some sort of weird experiment were the two that were sort of most prevalent amongst the people on the island.
Okay, that's good to hear, because I don't know, it doesn't sound to me like it's a fourth dimensional experience. I mean, it sounds like it's definitely something that's physically present in the field.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, when you look at, for example, the farm animals that have been killed, I mean, when I went with John Downs in 2004, we actually went out to a number of ranches where we were able to examine the animals. The interviews have been lined up for us by local civil defense people and veterinarians, and we were able to examine chickens, for example. We took literally two puncture marks on their neck, and then when the veterinarians did the autopsies, you know, there was barely any blood in them. So clearly this is a flesh and blood animal of some sort, or creature, if you like. So.
And the people agree that this is not trackable to any other kind of animal that could be out there.
This is one of the things a lot of people don't realize about Puerto Rico, is there's actually no indigenous to the island. There's no big cats or anything like that on Puerto Rico. It's actually quite like a sterile rainforest and location. The biggest animals on the island are farm animals, you know, like pigs or cows.
Well, anyway, cats wouldn't just puncture the throat.
No.
They, they tear up their prey.
Yeah, but I said there's nothing like gorillas, not that they would attack anybody anyway, but there's nothing like big cats or wild wolves or, you know, no wild wolves on the loose. Very much, you know, small animals, certainly not the sort of thing that would cause the chupacabra attacks. And of course, you know, if it was an animal that was on the island, we would have had reports for as long as people have been on Puerto Rico. That's what makes it sound like it's either an introduced animal or something that's just come from somewhere else since around about the early 1990s.
And do we have any military bases in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, there's a number of U.S. military bases. One or two have now closed down. But on the second occasion I went to Puerto Rico, I heard a number of stories from villagers and locals who all knew this particular rumor that supposedly two or three chupacabra had been captured by the U.S. military and transferred to a base on the island called Roosevelt Roads. And this was during the 90s particularly, was like a very heavy military presence, U.S. military presence there. And all the people broadly tell a similar story of these caged chupacabras being taken to the U.S. from this military base, having first been captured in the rainforest. So you do have like a deep, heavy U.S. military tie-in with the chupacabra story as well.
Well, it's not to say that they weren't, that they were found in the forest. It's just a cover, and they were actually coming out of some lab, underground lab.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's, admittedly, everybody I spoke with said, you know, this is what we've heard. And that's the thing I always try and point out, the distinction between what we know and some of the accounts we hear on the island, which may be second or third hand. But I think the important thing is that we do have people who we can interview, and we can then trace the story back to the original sources, hopefully, in some cases at least. In others, you know, you reach a dead end. But I don't think there's any doubt that something was going on with a heavy military presence in relation to the chupacabra.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you a question. I realize that you're very careful to be grounded in your observations, but I'm curious as to your personal experience or your personal intuition about this. Do you come away with your own insight into what's going on, or do you stay in a scientific mind?
Well, you know, one of the most important things I've found is that it seems that whatever the chupacabras is, or they are, they're very intelligent. They don't just seem like a random wild animal. They seem very stealthy in terms of being how they attack. There were a number of cases we investigated where chickens, for example, have been killed in their cages, but the cages hadn't been torn apart. The locks on them have been carefully opened. They weren't locks with keys, but they were kind of like where you push them one way, push them another, pick the lock up, etc.
Wow.
So I think the chupacabras are intelligent animals. Now, I do think in some respect, which I don't necessarily know how it relates to it, but there have been a lot of UFO reports in the same vicinity and time frames where chupacabras has been seen. Now, of course, that doesn't necessarily lend a connection to the genetic experiment. If it's a genetic experiment by the military, why would there be UFO connections? So, you know, I'm wondering, is there a connection between the military genetic experiments and the whole UFO issue as well? You know,
it's a great way to distract people anyway. It's confusing people.
But my best conclusion is that there's something on the island, a creature or creatures, that are linked with somehow with the military, with genetics, with UFOs, and that isn't just a random wild animal running around.
Wow, that's fascinating. Did you ever, your personal experiment was predominantly with chickens. You never saw any other animals that had been?
Oh, yes. Yeah, goats and pigs. We actually went to a pig farmer's house when I went there on the second occasion in 2005, and one of his pigs had been killed and one had been attacked. And the farmer had actually stayed up for two nights because on one night he'd had a pig killed, again with like vicious puncture marks on the neck. And then on the second night he heard all the animals screaming and making noises, but there wasn't an attack. Now on the third night, he actually, I guess, interrupted an attack on one of his pigs and managed to save its life, and said he saw this shadowy thing bounding off into the fields very, very quickly. Far quicker than, he's almost bouncing like a kangaroo might run, something along those lines.
Have there been ever any reports of attacks on humans?
Every time I've been there, I've heard rumors, but I will have to admit that this particular aspect of the story is one where I've never been able to track it down to an original source. A lot of people have heard these accounts, but then again, as one person I interviewed said to me, you know, if there have been attacks on people, that's probably the one area that the military, more than any other, would keep under wraps, and that it would be difficult to prove, which I think is quite right. So
in other words, the people are very aware of the potential military connection, and they're careful.
Oh yeah, the people on Puerto Rico are happy to talk to you when they realize you're doing serious investigations and you're not there just to sensationalize things. They become more trustworthy and open about speaking. And that's the thing I found. You have to be very sort of respectful of their culture, and you don't just go over there and demand they tell you this or that. You explain what you're doing and allow them to understand that you're not there just to sensationalize things.
Sure.
And then you get people talking to you. But as I said, the whole human attack angle is one that has been difficult to prove. It doesn't mean it's not real. It just means we've just got to dig further than, the average attack on a goat or a pig or whatever.
Well, let's hope we don't find that. That would be too creepy.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, so what do you think about, I'm sure that you're well aware of all of the hype we're getting now in the media, and it very much seems like we are getting prepared for, I think you'll agree, for disclosure. What are your feelings?
Well, I think it's interesting that with the UFO subject, we tend to get these sort of waves where it seems like everybody and his brother is speaking about the subject at an official level. You know, the Vatican was saying something just recently as well, and the Catholic Church.
That's right. That's important to pay attention to.
Yes. And, you mentioned NASA at the start of the interview. And then you find government agencies in different countries, like England, for example, where I'm originally from, releasing a lot of their UFO files into the public domain. And I think what this shows is that there's a tremendous ability to expose the public and the media to the UFO subject very, very quickly. And I think what's probably happening, in my view at least, is that the people on the inside do this to test the reaction. And depending on the reaction of, disclosure A in 1997 or disclosure B in 2002, when they release a bit more information, they gauge what the response is, and eventually, I think that will possibly lead to an opening up of what's going on. But I think it's one of these things where it's almost like a subtle release of information where everybody actually, by the time disclosure or the release information, the hard information comes, everybody's sort of acclimatized to accept it anyway. I think that's what they're trying to do. It's been going on
for a long, long time.
Yeah.
It definitely seems to be accelerating now.
Yes.
And I think the statistics are something like 80 out of 100 people believe in ET anyway, despite what it sounds like people believe out there. When you really get down to it, I think this is not going to be as much of a shocker to people as those in power think it would be.
Yeah, I think had it been the case that they'd just come out and released the information when nobody was really thinking about the subject or wasn't exposed to it, that probably would be a shock. But you're quite right that in today's world, everybody, I think, most people suspect there's something to the UFO subject. And so in that respect, it's not going to be the big shocker that it might be 25 years ago, if you like.
Yeah, definitely. So let's talk about some of your experiences with the contactees and people that have had that firsthand experience with aliens. By the way, aliens are definitely walking amongst us, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is what the whole crux of the book is. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people who are new to the subject today will obviously have heard of things like alien abductions, these more sort of cold, clinical incidents and experiences where people are almost treated like lab rats and experimented upon. But if you go back to the late 40s, 50s and 60s, which is predominantly where my contactee's book is focused on. You had a lot of reports from people all across the world claiming contact with very human-like aliens that looked very much like us, that could actually pass for us, and the only major difference being that many of them had reported they had heads of long blonde hair, which, of course, you know, the average American or British male in the 50s, you know, you didn't see long blonde hair. And so that they kind of stood out, but they were described as being very human-looking. And many of the so-called original contactees, they became known as contactees because the aliens would, I guess, want to speak to them on a one-to-one basis and talk about their concerns relative to nuclear war, how we should all live in peace and harmony with each other and kind of raise ourselves to new, I guess, almost like spiritual levels, if you like. And many of the contactees, actually, the way the experiences began, they felt compelled, for no reason they really understood, to drive out to remote locations like deserts or mountaintops, not really knowing why they were doing it. And then when they got out there, these classic flying saucers would come down and these very human-like aliens would come out. Now, of course, you know, it's a very controversial aspect of the UFO subject when you're talking about human-like aliens moving amongst us. And as I point out in the book, possibly even trying to infiltrate the military and the government, but for reasons that they perceived as being relative to positive change in the human species and the way we act.
Well, that's what's so nice and what's so refreshing about your book is that, you know, we do have so many horror stories about abductees and what they've been through, as you said, being treated in laboratory scenes. Mm-hmm. So this very human positive experience is a great story to be told, and I'm glad that you've done this, I'm glad that people can have this perspective as well. So I'd like to talk about, for example, are you going to the story of George Adamski
mm-hmm.
and what happened to him in the desert when he met human-like aliens?
You know, Adamski, without doubt, is, as I point out in the book, certainly, I guess, you know, the ultimate premier contactee. He's the one that everybody thinks of because, not necessarily for the most part, but, you know, in terms of the being in the public eye, he was the man who really kicked it all off. Now, Adamski actually has an interesting background. He was originally from Poland, and his parents moved to the U.S. when he was, like, 2 years old. In the 1930s, he actually developed a deep interest in alternative lifestyles and alternative wisdoms and set up an organization called the Royal Order of Tibet, which was, I guess, in many respects, like an alternative religious-type commune situation in California. And he ran that for a number of years and then moved to Mount Palomar, California, and reported a number of sightings of large UFOs in the late 1940s, actually before Kenneth Arnold's famous incident that kicked off the UFO subject in the summer of 47. Adamski's cases actually began in 46. But I suppose the most relevant to the contactee subject of his experiences occurred in the summer of 1952, when he said that, again, he felt driven to go to one particular area of the desert in California with several friends, one being another contactee, a man named George Hunt Williamson, and said that, again, this classic flying saucer-type craft came down in the desert, and this long-haired, very human-looking alien came out of the craft, and there was Adamski felt compelled to go forward, pretty much alone, while all the others kept back, and there was this exchange, again, relative to the perils, if you like, of atomic weaponry and, again, how we need to, you know, kind of all live together as one human race rather than as individual countries. And this was one of many experiences that Adamski claimed, and also George Hunt Williamson. And it was a situation more than anything else that really kicked off the whole contactee movement. And Adamski's story was told in a book published the following year and co-written with a man named Desmond Leslie, and the book was called Flying Saucers Have Landed. And again, it was basically a study of the UFO subject from that period and the contactee movement. And it sold somewhere in the region of like 120,000 copies. So it really influenced a lot of people in the UFO subject. You know, books on UFOs today, I know from experience, don't sell anywhere near that sort of amount. And so
it was a classic.
Oh, yeah, he was really like a mover and shaker in the field at the time, and he kicked off that movement.
And, you know, it's so similar to the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I just wonder sometimes if they didn't kind of take from the Adamski story to do that film.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, I wrote a book not long ago called Science Fiction Secrets, which was actually a way in which a study of how government agencies had possibly subtly influenced the world of science fiction movies and books and authors to promote UFO ideas, again, to, I guess, acclimatize the public. And you're quite right. I think, actually, the sci-fi movie that more than any other kind of typifies the whole contactee movement was probably the original version of The Day the Earth Stood Still, which was remade a year or so ago with Keanu Reeves in the main role. But in that one, you have a very human-like alien come down who infiltrates our society and, again, warns us, you know, of how we face nuclear destruction, etc., and the response, unfortunately, of the human race is to try and kill him. But you know, which is, I guess, typical of what we do.
I have to interject here that when you say, and of course, the reaction is to try to kill him, because I had Stanton Freeman, who I'm sure you know, on my show.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, what do you say, Stanton? Do you think we're going to get, you know, some good aliens coming in and a good reaction, you know, from the human race? And he said, well, if we just stop shooting at everything, we might have a chance to set up a good dialogue.
Yeah,
and it's so true. I mean, you know, we are pretty violent species down here.
Well, that's the unfortunate thing. And I think the thing I've tried to point out in the book is that I think that's why so many of these contactee experiences occur where they try to approach the public and the people rather than, you know, people always say, why don't aliens land on the White House lawn? Well, because they probably would get shot. You know, if they try and infiltrate, and I don't mean infiltrate in a sinister way, but I mean if they try to infiltrate and go direct to the people, the population, and bypass the government, what that actually does, that actually then exposes the general public to the subject directly without government meddling and government secrecy. And I think, I think that's what's happened, is that at some point, you know, there's however many planets they may have done this on before, who knows, but the realization hit home with them that governments don't want change. Governments want to remain the people in charge. They don't want to see people's mindsets and views on the whole world issues altered. You know, they want us to be like the little subservient people saying, yes, sir, thank you, sir.
And they don't want to end war.
No, that's right.
Because war is profit.
War is profit. And so for that reason...
So if we get the scenario, I talk about this all the time, where we've got the entire human race confronting the reality that we are not alone and that we are members of a galactic consciousness, a galactic civilization, war on Earth becomes kind of secondary to the... Mm-hmm. intensity of that discovery.
Yeah, and I think governments don't want that. And I think
definitely not. War is money.
Yeah, and I think these intelligence...
No matter what they tell us about ending the war or finishing the job or whatever their little catchphrases are, the bottom line is the rich get richer on war, period. Follow the money trail.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a realization on the part of these alien intelligences that to bypass... you know, corrupt governments or whatever, and just go direct to the people is the way to get their word across. And that's it. That is why they don't land on the White House lawn, because the government would either kill them, try to kill them, or hide the story. You know, but the public want to hear it. So.
And plus, I'm sure they're intelligent enough to realize that it would be an excuse if they did arrive in a key location like that. The government would say, you see, we had to do something about it to protect you against the new terrorists would be the aliens, right?
Yeah,
so
that's
they've got to come in a way that does not appear to be aggressive in any way, and landing in the White House lawn would probably appear that way.
Yeah, you're quite right. The whole point of government is to ensure the people are under its control, and one way you do that is by creating fear, whether that fear exists really or not, you know, whether it's a real fear or a manufactured fear.
I have to think, considering all the hype there is in the media right now about this couple that crashed the White House dinner, that might be a great way for them to come in, just crash an event at the White House.
Well, you know, it's interesting because one of the things I talk about in the book, there's a whole chapter on this, is how there are a lot of allegations that in the 50s in particular, these very human-like aliens actually infiltrated the Pentagon. And, we're actually moving amongst, you know, some of the higher figures within the military, not from a threatening perspective, but trying to, again, understand what our military was doing and trying to subtly influence us and possibly, you know, infiltrating the Russian governments and the British governments. I also talk about how this was done with the British Ministry of Defense, that there was a very high up source within the British Ministry of Defense who claimed face-to-face contact with an alien that he called Mr. Janus, who again spoke at length about how we need to live in peace with one another. And this guy had actually approached, the man's name was Sir Peter Horsley. He was actually one of the top people within the British military in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, he was visited by one of these people. So, by his own admission, even. And so this shows, you know, the extent to which possibly the military is being infiltrated and influenced, I guess, to try and change its, you know, its mindset.
Oh, it's very encouraging. Let's hope that we can have that kind of intervention to hopefully somehow soften the military perspective of what's really going on.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind, you know, this slightly getting off UFOs, but, you know, there's a huge amount of manipulation in today to get us to accept this idea or that idea relative to going to war, when really you look into it, it's just a profit thing for the elite. That's all it is, you know, and grabbing oil.
Yeah, I just recently did an interview, and I said, I'm tired of war. I know this sounds ridiculously simplistic, but let's stop it already. I mean, why do people go? Why do people sign up to go die?
Because this, unfortunately,
this ridiculous ideal of patriotism?
Yeah, that's what it
is.
Or
is this some kind of hypnotic trance they're in, or what? I don't understand why anyone would willingly go to die for nothing.
I think, you know, if you're going to fight a war, and it's for a valid reason, that's fine. But, you know, it seems today so much of it is just about stealing oil, grabbing oil, profit.
That's right.
It's not about a literal threat facing the country as such, or you know, certain whichever country. Yes, there's an angle of that to it. But overall, it's about manipulation, control, ensuring, you know,
ensuring
the oil fields, you know.
But people believe the patriotism marketing line. And getting back to the aliens, I would imagine that it would be easy to convince a lot of people that they governments are now going to have to protect us against the aliens. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. That is for sure.
Yeah, I think, you know, whether it's...
To put it mildly.
Yeah. You know, it's like the Soviets were the threat, now it's a terrorist. Then it's going to be something else. Then
it'll be aliens. That'll be the new terrorists.
The aliens, and then it'll be something like meteorites or asteroids hitting the planet, or, you know, it's like
fireballs from the sun.
Yeah. Anything that's going to frighten.
Back to your book. You talked about Adamski. You said that the FBI released some of the files showing that they really spied on Adamski, and Van Tassel, who's another contactee that you talk about in the book. What was revealed in those FBI files regarding the contactees?
It's interesting that many of the early contactees were watched very, very closely by the FBI, particularly, as you said, George Adamski and George Van Tassel. But I also got files on other contactees, George Hunt Williamson, who I mentioned earlier, Frank Stranges, who was a man who actually whole angle of the military the aliens infiltrating the Pentagon and infiltrating the military. So in that respect, you know, it's interesting that the FBI didn't dismiss these people, but what they did, they opened huge files on them. Now, for example, the file on George Van Tassel, which I was able to get from the FBI through the Freedom of Information Act, is nearly 400 pages in length. And it talks about how the FBI would literally go to send agents out to his conferences and sit in the audience, you know, just dressed like, I guess, T-shirts, jeans, not to sort of stand out as, you know, looking like, typical FBI agents, you know, in suits and sunglasses or whatever. But the FBI was very interested in hearing about the so-called politics of the aliens. What sort of government did they have? What a lot of people find surprising is that the FBI actually didn't hide their surveillance. For example, or not completely. For example, on several occasions, FBI agents openly went to George Van Tassel's home in Landers, California, and said, you know, can we speak to you about your claimed experiences, about the nature of government these aliens have and what they want? So, you know, it wasn't the case that the FBI were trying, say, like Project Blue Book, to explain away the UFO subject. They're actually wanting to know what the contactees felt was going on and why it was going on. So that's sort of like a big difference between the military's approach and the FBI's approach. But, you know, I think it's interesting when you examine the contactee history, clearly they were doing something of significance if they've got the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover on their back for, in the case of George Van Tassel, you know, they're watching him for like 14 years. You know, it shows that the influence and the significance of their cases. And I think again, the FBI's concern goes back to what we were just talking about. The FBI didn't want to see the fabric of society changed radically by aliens that wanted people to think for themselves and not listen to what the government was telling them.
For sure. And there may even have been a time when they were concerned of really concerned about protecting humanity, but I just don't think that's the profile anymore.
No, I think you're quite right there. There's no doubt that in the early years, you know, it was more along the lines of there's a mystery and the people need to be protected and we don't want this to happen. But today I think, you know, it's just manipulation and fear factor, you know, pulling the strings, you know.
Right, because I think they've got plenty of people, they've got plenty of aliens that they're in contact with, and they know the picture, and they know the story, and they also know, I think, it looks to me like they've been given some kind of a mandate. Either you bring this out or we will.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt there's something going on. I will be the first to admit I don't know what the ultimate outcome is going to be, but, you know, it does look like things are moving forward to something. Yeah.
You can feel it.
Yes.
Hooray already. I've only been waiting for this since I'm 12 years old. All right, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, you described the aliens that come to appear to these contactees, declaring that they're Space Brothers.
Mm.
And you use this term a lot in the book. So please explain to us what you mean by Space Brothers. What do they look like? And did they claim their origins to any given star system?
Yeah, the term Space Brothers actually isn't one of my creation. This is what the contactees one of the contactees actually sort of created this term. And the reason why was to I guess get across this idea that they were, yes, they were alien, but equally they were on a similar level to us, and they were like brotherly creatures, brotherly beings. They weren't, you know, ominous alien creatures, if you like. So the idea was that there was like a more like a gentle experience, a gentle angle, and that they were communing with us and wanted some sort of one-to-one contact that would be beneficial. Now, most of the contactees said that the aliens they met looked very human-like. Often slightly taller than us, sort of 6'3", 6'4".
And very blonde.
Very blonde, long hair.
I've met a couple.
What's that, sorry?
I've met a couple.
Oh, okay. Oh, cool.
That's
interesting, that because today, you know, although the contactees aren't so much prevalent in the UFO subject as they were 50, 60 years ago, we do actually still get a lot of reports, which today become known as silent contactee reports, where people have these same classic experiences, but not so many people perhaps talk about them. But they're often also described as wearing like one piece, almost like a ski suit type outfit, as one of the witnesses described them, flying in, you know, definitive flying saucers, usually with tripod landing gear, craft anywhere from 30 to 100 feet in diameter. Now, you talked about their point of origin. A number of the contactees, you know, were told that their original location was planets in our solar system. Others gave star systems far away. My personal belief is that I think there was some sort of deception on their part in revealing who they actually were and where they were from. I think, to an extent at least, that's understandable, that they were almost like, you know, testing the waters before they had a full realization of who we were, what we were. They were being guarded in their approach. And I think
that would make sense.
Yeah, and I think that explains why in some cases there's been, you know, discrepancies about points of origin, that which is understandable. You know, if they're concerned that the military or the government's on their trail, they're going to want to put them off the trail, put them off the scent. And I think you do that they obviously wanted to get a particular ideology and philosophy over to people, but they didn't want other people potentially, you know, be enemies to them, if you like, finding out where they were, what they were doing, even where, you know, they were hiding out on the earth. I mean, you know, if they're moving amongst us, they're obviously living somewhere. And I think all this comes into play. There was a very careful approach of how they liaise with us, and part of it did involve deception about where they were coming from.
So what I'm hearing you say is that you believe that they're is a civilization of aliens on the earth that do not want to be known to the government.
Yeah, I think there's several things going on. I think there's been, you know, one of the things I point out in the book is that there could be an alien intelligence. Some people have said that actually we haven't actually seen its real form, and that possibly it can, I guess, manifest in ways that are more acceptable to us, you know, that it literally transforms itself into the idea of human-looking aliens, because that's less threatening. But I think, you know, in the broader sense, you know, when you look at credible military sources, all talk like Sir Peter Horsley in the British Ministry of Defence, talking about very human-looking aliens moving amongst us, having concerns about nuclear war, and actually being able to, you know, turn up on the front doorstep of high-ranking military personnel. I mean, Sir Peter Horsley, it's kind of like for listeners in the US listening to this show, it's kind of like having an alien turn up on the doorstep of Colin Powell, and then him saying,
"Wow,"
and then saying, "I met an alien, and we discussed, you know, atomic disarmament and how we all need to live in peace." That is quite literally.
He says that he had an alien show up.
Yeah, I mean, this is quite literally the military level that Sir Peter Horsley held. You know, he was one of the guys who, in the event of a nuclear war, would have had his finger on the button. That's how high up the chain of command he was. So, you know, I think it's impossible to dismiss these accounts that there are human-like aliens amongst us and infiltrating us. And as I said, I don't think it's necessary to put a sinister slant on the word infiltrate. I think it's more along the lines of subtly influencing us without us actually realizing what's going on.
Let's say integrate.
Yeah, that's probably a good way of putting it, yeah.
What do you think is the link with the crop circle phenomenon? Have you been there?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, originally from England. I moved over to the U.S. in 2001. My wife's originally from the U.S., and we moved back here a few years ago. But, you know, throughout the 90s, I used to go down to Wiltshire, where most of the crop circles, the county of England where most of the crop circles appear every year. I used to go down there regularly, and I actually have a chapter in the book which deals with contactee and so-called space brother encounters within crop circles. And there was actually one very recently where a police officer had seen several of these tall, long blonde-haired figures all dressed identically in kind of like white jumpsuits in a crop circle. Now, if this was just a one-off, you could just say, well, is it tourists or something? But we actually have a number of these cases on file where the space brothers, the contactee aliens, seem to have a deep interest in crop circles and the more spiritual aspects of them as well. I've interviewed a number of people, one who allowed me to use her story in the book. And so in that respect, I think, you know, the crop circle mystery, there's no doubt it's a very deep spiritual one that has a profound effect on people. And importantly,
yes,
like...
in fact, I go to crop circles every year. I'm going to back up here. So you were saying that you interviewed someone who's had that experience in the crop circles. Are you talking about encountering space brothers or alien beings there?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually one that was, the story was recorded just a few months ago in Britain's Daily Telegraph newspaper. And, you know, the Telegraph is kind of like the Washington Post or the New York Times. It's sort of
great.
Yeah, it's a very well-respected newspaper. And they talked about how, for example, the Ministry of Defense had just recently released a file which talked about how a lady had actually met a very human-looking being who began talking about crop circles and how they were important to the alien presence on Earth. And she at first just thought, you know, he was a slightly unusual guy who had an interest in UFOs. But he apparently then walked off to where there was a thick group of trees. And she said suddenly out of the trees, this large glowing object rose up and shot off into the sky. And then she realized that this was some sort of alien being that was trying to get across a philosophy relative to the message that the crop circles were trying to put across, or the makers of the crop circles were trying to put across. And this is actually recorded in Ministry of Defense files, so, you know, that in itself is pretty significant.
Well, I have had such an experience, which I would love to elaborate with you at another time.
Okay.
Of encountering people in the field who most definitely appear to be aliens.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of people have these experiences. I think, unfortunately, the thing I found with the contactee movement, what makes it unfortunate is that if you look at abductions and the aliens, you know, these small creatures with large heads and large black eyes, that's what people have come to accept, and so people are more perhaps apt to talking about it. When you begin speaking about human-looking aliens who speak English and can move amongst us and infiltrate us, a lot of people are reluctant to talk about it because it sounds so outrageous and controversial. Now, it doesn't mean the experiences aren't real. I'm personally convinced they are. But it means that the more controversial, the less likely we are, unfortunately, to have the people be willing to come forward. You know,
well, there's also the factor that it's very hard to believe it when you're experiencing it, because you look at these people, there's something that's just not quite right.
Yeah.
But the camouflage is excellent. I mean, they've got, they look very normal. They look very human. But there's just something that's not right. So
I'm
as
right.
a psychic, I could say it's their energy field, but nobody's going to be able to relate to that if they're not in that mindset. So what I do tell people is there's something about the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the people that I've met, they never take off their sunglasses ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one time they did when I saw them, because I've seen them more than once.
Mm-hmm.
The eyes were very strange.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you should say that, because in my contactees book, I actually relate the experience of a 1950s contactee named Truman Betherham. And Betherham claimed a number of close encounters with very human-like aliens in Nevada, where he was working at the time. And he said that, to his great surprise, after he had these initial encounters and he recognized what these people would look like, that they looked like us but slightly dissimilar and there was something slightly off about them. When he would sort of, for example, go into Las Vegas and other towns and cities, occasionally he would see people that very much reminded him of these aliens, but they seemed to have, as you said, sunglasses, and in some cases the women would have, you know, scarves pulled tightly around their heads and faces. So they were almost pretty much camouflage, but he was able to sort of detect there was something about them. And of course, that was because he'd been exposed to the aliens originally, but for everybody else, you know, we might potentially, as crazy as it sounds, see these people every day in the big cities, but you don't think about it, just the fact that they've got sunglasses and wraparound hats on or whatever. You don't give it a second thought unless you've actually been exposed to the phenomenon. So, you know, it makes me kind of wonder exactly how many of these beings could be out there, you know, moving amongst us every single day.
Yeah, and what really amazes me about what you've said is that in the dialogue that I've had with these people, they talk about this, that the crop circles are a logical place that alien life would want to encounter human life, because they are fields of consciousness that are relevant to interdimensional and interterrestrial contact. So, woo! I really need to talk to you about this more, Nick. We'll have to do this in a private conversation and then maybe come have you back on the air at another time.
All right.
So, boy, you've definitely validated a few things in my mind here. You've talked about this contact in a past tense. Like you said, when they were contacting, the Space Brothers had the contact. But you do agree that this is a very present situation.
Yeah, the important thing I've stressed in the book is that there's absolutely no doubt that the contact team movement, in terms of having like a visible profile on a large scale, was in the 50s and 60s. Now, what I found is that I don't think there's any less number of contactee experiences today versus what there was in the 50s and 60s. The thing that I've seen that's changed is that many of today's contactees, again, because of the controversial nature of the subject, they're not as outspoken as, say, for example, people like George Adamski or George Van Tassel were. I mean, for example, I interviewed a lady from England just recently. We've corresponded over the course of the last couple of months, who's had classic contactee experiences that easily rival George Adamski, and she's had these from the mid-70s right through till the present day. But she doesn't like to go public with them. And I think when there's a lack of people going public on one particular aspect of the UFO subject, people think it's vanished, it's gone away. But it actually hasn't.
Well, it certainly hasn't done that.
No. That's the thing with people like
it. I unfortunately, believe it or not, we're already at the end of the hour, and we've only merely just scratched the surface here. So I'm going to have you back on. Will you come back?
Oh, sure. I'll be happy to come back, Pat. Thanks.
Okay, and we will pick it up from here because there's just so much wisdom and so little time, as they say. But I do need to make sure that people know how to reach you. Your book is Contactees, again, A History of Alien-Human Interaction. Our guest is and the author is Nick Redfern. His website is www.nickredfern.com.
Correct.
And we're going to have him back, and I'm going to talk to Nick about what I've experienced in the crop field, and I'm pretty sure a lot of you are going to be interested in that. Meanwhile, you can send me emails or questions. I'm on Facebook. If you'd like to talk about what you've heard today, drop me a message, and we will do everything we can to have Nick back on as soon as possible. So, Nick, I hate to say goodbye at the moment, but it'll just be a momentary reprieve until you can come back.
That's all right, Pat, and I'll be glad to come back whenever you want me on.
Okay, fantastic. And we'll have to have that little conversation, okay?
We'll do that.
All righty. Thanks, Nick. Is there anything you'd like to leave people with before we sign out? We've got 2 minutes.
Well, you know, I would just say that because people are still experiencing these contactee type encounters, you know, I would encourage people to come forward. If you've experienced it, you know, don't stay behind closed doors. There's a reason you're being contacted, and part of it at least is to help get the word out and change the public mindset. So I would encourage people to come forward and understand also that, you know, I've I treat the subject fairly, and you know, it's not a subject I'm knocking or anything like that. It's a very valid aspect of the UFO subject that people need to know about.
Unquestionably, your heart comes through, and your level of balance between the scientific approach and the intuition is all there.
Well, thanks.
You're doing a great job, Nick.
Well, thanks, Pat. Thank you.
Thank you, too. Okay, everybody, next week I'm going to have another worldly guest on, Linda. Andrew Basiago. He's going to be, have I seen some amazing pictures from this man. He'll be talking about life on Mars. You do not want to miss that show. And we just keep getting more and more out there on Beyond the Matrix, the show that asks you to soar out of the box of convention and fly out there with the eagles in the free thought zone with Patricia Corey. Thank you for being with me. Be with you next week. Arrivederci, my friends. Arrivederci.